Welcome to Explore Riverside Weekly, the show that explores all the things that makes the city of arts innovation a great place to live, work, and play. My name is Greg Lee, and I am amped about today's guest. In fact, we're just sitting here talking sports, actually not really starting on time, but that's fine. I've done a lot of interviews, but today's guest is on the top of my list. Nationally known for his work as a head basketball coach and as an athletics administrator, our guest led the UCR Highlanders in the transition to Division I in 1999. Former UCR Chancellor Raymond Orbach described this man's appointment as one of the most significant in UCR's distinguished athletic history. As director of athletics, he oversaw all aspects of the athletics program and guided UCR through the transition into Division I, including the selection of the Big West Conference and the expansion of UCR sports programs and facilities. College basketball star, European All-Star, collegiate head coach, color commentator, personal coach and consultant to Shaquille O'Neal, athletic director, community leader, and an overall incredible individual, we welcome Mr. Stan Morrison to the Explore Riverside Weekly Show. Welcome, Stan.
Thank you, Greg. My goodness, will you send a copy of that to my wife?
Don't see the drum roll and a clapping there.
Right. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, I really appreciate you coming on the show. And I can spend all day interviewing you, so let's just jump right in because we only have a 25-minute show. Give us a quick 3-minute autobiography on Stan Morrison.
Well, I was raised in Southern California. I was born in a place called Linwood, which is South Central LA today, and had an awkward childhood simply because we were poor, and ended up in Bellflower, where I went to high school. Actually, I lived in Lakewood, lived farther from campus than anyone, and went to a Bellflower High School and never had played basketball. I was a baseball guy. I was a track guy. And believe it or not, I was a gymnast as a little kid.
Wait a second. Stan, you are now 6'8".
Right.
Were you tall growing up? Because I don't see you as a gymnast.
No, I was 5'8 as a freshman in high school. I grew to 6 feet. And then 6'3", and then 6'5", my senior year. Good graduated Lord. At 6'6", and grew an inch that summer, and went to Berkeley at 6'7". And played at Cal. I was lucky. A gentleman was sent by Pete Newell, who was my coach, to see Jerry Pym, a high school All-American. And I had a really good game, and instead of going to his locker room, he came to mine, and the rest is history. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I went to Cal and as an art and architecture student, and my sophomore year, we got to this thing called the Final Four, and we beat Oscar Robertson in the semis and Jerry West in the finals to be the national champions. And I said simply, I want to be in this environment as much as possible. So I changed my major to physical education, thinking it was going to be easy, right? Until I was competing with pre-med kids in anatomy, kinesiology, and exercise physiology, and it was good. It was a great major, and I then went to Europe and played a year of international basketball for the richest then sports club in the world, Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. And soccer, of course, was their big sport, and I played basketball. And we got to the finals of the European Championships and played all over Europe and North Africa. Came back and was a grad assistant at Berkeley and coached the Blues. In those days, you had the freshman team, and the Blues were kind of a JV team. So guys that were on the varsity and weren't seeing much time would have a chance to play a community college schedule, a limited schedule. But it was great for me to have a chance to start and get my feet wet as a coach. And then I got my teacher credential and played for the San Francisco Olympic Club and then went on to my first high school job, which was in Sacramento at El Camino High School. Went from there to San Jose State for 4 years as the assistant coach there and the freshman coach, and then went from there to USC, where I served as the freshman coach and assistant varsity coach for the last 2 years that freshmen had to play freshman ball. And in fact, that last year, we had the best freshman team in America, and it was a lot of fun. I was flat broke, needed a job. I was offered 5 jobs and took the job at University of the Pacific. And in 1972, was there till 79. In 79, we won the championship. And for 8 days, I left coaching. And I was the national director of sales for Granada Royal Hotels. They're the people that started with every room is a suite, free breakfast, free cocktail.
You say hour. 8 days?
8 days. Because I was flying back, and I was determined I was going to become one of the wealthy people in America. Today, they're called, by the way, Embassy Suites. So I came home and my wife said, you better sit down. I said, why is that? And she said, Dr. Perry, director of athletics at USC, called. He wants you to be the coach. And I said, what do you think? She said, I don't want you kicking yourself in the rear 20 years from now. Let's go do it. Well, it was apparent that everybody had turned down the job because no one wanted to coach against the monster across town in UCLA. SC had not beaten UCLA in 10 years. And as the good Lord would have it, the first time we played them, 14,405 people showed up in the LA sports arena, and two-thirds of them wearing baby blue.
Oh.
And we beat them. And we managed to beat them 14 times we played over my 7 years there, and had a lot of fun. And that was an honor to coach at USC. I then became associate athletic director at USC for 3 months, and then went to UC Santa Barbara for 3 years as director of athletics. Interestingly, at that same time, I was offered the job at UC Riverside back in 1986. But because Santa Barbara was already Division I, and that's all I had ever known, it made sense for me to go there. But I missed coaching too much, and so I went back to coach at San Jose State for the next 9 years. An immense challenge, one of the most difficult things I've ever done in my life. I inherited a team where the players had walked out on the former coach. And so he finished the season with football and baseball guys. And on my media day, after I met with the media, they took me into a room. There were two guys sitting there, Dwayne Daniels and Tommy Desiano. That was my whole team. So I went on campus and recruited anybody over 6'3" and gave them a scholarship, and it was the Bad News Bears revisited. Did that and left that in, after 9 years, and got involved in the entrepreneurial world. And then UC Riverside came after me because they had made a commitment to go to Division I from Division II. And because my whole family was in Southern California, it made sense. And I had a sense of the campus. And I came back, and that is another challenge. It was a very, very tough 12 years, but it's a great university, and I'm really happy to have had that chance. When I had announced my departure from UC Riverside, a month before I left, I was at a social. And the CEO of Security Bank of California, Jim Robinson, who had done the mortgage on my home in Palos Verdes when I took the job at USC, asked me to join him. And I said, Jim, I don't know one thing about your world. And he said, you take people to breakfast and lunch and tell them how wonderful we are. He said, you have the best Rolodex of anybody
yes,
we
you
know.
Do. Yes, you do.
And I do that, and I'm really good at it. And it's a great place. It's a great bank. I'm so thrilled to be there, and I'm involved in an awful lot here in the community as well.
Well, let's take a step back. Let's go back to UCR. Because as you said, in 1999, you oversaw UCR's transition from Division II, D2, to Division I sports. Walk us through that transition, and why was it so important for the campus to make that move, and really how difficult was it?
Well, at the NCAA convention annually, Chancellor Ray Orbach would be back there with his buddies from UCLA and SC and everywhere else, and then it was time to go to meetings, and he didn't get to go to their meetings, and he didn't like that. He wanted to go to their meetings and hear what they were talking about, and certainly he had been at UCLA. He understood what Division One was about. He had been the provost there, so when he came here, he thought, you know, the highest level, people will resonate to that, the only Division One school in the Inland Empire. And he made that commitment, and they pulled the trigger after going and visiting with every Big West school's chancellor or president. And he was exceedingly well-staffed. He had the vice chancellor at the time, Dr. Mike Webster, and he had Cliff Docterman with him, who really did the staffing and told him about the personality of each campus and where and how the president or chancellor of that institution was thinking. And so in the Reno airport, they all looked at each other, and the chancellor said, I'm pulling the trigger. We're going D1. And so we came in and went to work. And, boy, it was really, really hard work. And, you know, you have to go a long period of time there before you can play for a championship. I think it was worth it. I think there are things in place that can make it a great institution, but it does take the community to support it in every way.
Well, you had to bring on new sports to the campus in order to meet the Division I requirement, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, you have to have 14 sports, and with Title IX, obviously, you want to have 7 and 7, and in fact, they have 17 sports, and it's really interesting. And you know, you have, for instance, men's and women's track, and you have the same kids running men's and women's indoor track, and then you have some of the same kids running men's and women's cross country. So that's 6 sports, but you have 2 teams that are accomplishing that. They added men's and women's golf at that time. And they added, they had volleyball, obviously, under Sue Gazanski at that time, but they got it up to 17 sports.
And so how difficult is it to have to play now? Because you're in the big leagues. Division I is a big league. Yeah. So you've got to play against the SCs of the world. How difficult was that?
It was exceedingly difficult. Part of the transition is, you know, a kid goes to bed today and he's Division II, and you wake up in the morning, do you have a Division I stamp on your rear end? How do you make that adjustment? Trust me when I say this. They lace them up differently. Division I, real Division I athletes are different than Division II athletes. They're bigger, stronger, faster, yes. They look at things through a different lens. Their competitiveness is fierce. The truly successful ones understand that, and they really get after it. And so it's simply different. Great Division II programs are populated with Division I student athletes, kids that for whatever reason didn't make it, or maybe they transferred in simply wanting a little bit lower level of competition. So it was very, very tough. Another part of it was the transition mentally for coaches. I mean, we had some coaches who simply couldn't make that transition. We had others who did. One in mind that comes to my mind is our baseball coach that we had, Jack Smitherin. It took him 30 seconds. It took him 30 seconds. I mean, he was competing head-to-head with UCLA and USC and beating them in baseball and playing anybody who would play him. And that program has always been a Division I program, you know, no matter what the label says. When you get into sports like basketball and softball and certainly volleyball, it is a different world. It is truly different, and the adjustment is an enormous one because the manner in which you conduct the program has to be very, very different. The manner in which you recruit. In the past, you may have been able to wait, and they would be lined up outside your door to come. Now you had to go out and go to their door, go to their home, and sell your institution, sell your program, sell yourself, and sell the young people that were joining new kids coming in and convincing kids to be pioneers.
We're going to take a short commercial break because I have some other questions about the NCAA and some of the work that you're doing. So we're going to take this short commercial break and we'll be right back and continue our conversation with former UCR Director of Athletics, Stan Morrison, right here on Explore Riverside Weekly.
If you had knowledge of your energy consumption data, would it help you cut down on your energy costs? Sure it would. And with the Kilowatt Easy Energy Usage Monitor, it's easy. Here's all you have to do. Go to the library. That's right. Go to any Riverside Public Library and borrow a Kilowatt monitor. Take it home just like you would a library book. Plug the monitor into an outlet and your appliance into the monitor. You'll get real-time information on how much it will cost to operate. Knowing what these devices cost to operate will help you make better judgments when using them. So start saving energy. Go to the library, borrow a monitor and a book. Test your appliances, turn off the TV, and read. It's fundamental, it's environmental, and it can save you money. For more information, call 951-826-5485. 951-826-5485. Riverside Public Utilities. Water. Energy. Life.
AM 590. The Answer.
Hello and welcome back to Explore Riverside Weekly. I'm Greg Lee, and we are talking with my guest, former UCR Director of Athletics, Stan Morrison. Stan, in the spring of 2006, you're appointed to the NCAA Men's Basketball Committee. Now, this committee is responsible for the oversight and administration of the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Championship Tournament, or as we all like to call it, March Madness. And that includes selecting the 65 teams that participate in the tournament. For all of us basketball fanatics, can you talk to us about how the teams are chosen and the economic impact March Madness has on collegiate sports?
Well, first of all, there are 68 teams.
68.
Yes, right. Secondly, it was the biggest honor of my administrative career in athletics. It's a huge, huge honor to be one of those 10 men and women. And I was selected because the Big West Conference really got behind me, and I wrote a letter to every one of the committee members saying I want to be a part of this action. And also I was selected because I had coached the game, and there aren't a whole lot of people on the tournament who have in fact coached it. That doesn't mean they don't know the game and don't have great love for the game, but they having coached it, it was really an interesting thing, and I think I brought a perspective to the process that was interesting.
So what was their background? Were they administrators? Were they boosters? What was their background?
No, they're all either commissioners or directors of athletics, one of the two. and very, very bright people, very, very involved people, extremely competitive, hardworking. You know, you really put in time. If you are the chairman, you virtually are not in your office for a full year. It is that hard and trying. You've got to be really, if you're an athletic director, you have to be at a big institution with lots of assistant and associate athletic directors to run the ship while you're gone. You know, selecting the 68 teams is a really interesting thing. Each of the 10 members are assigned as primaries on conferences. And so all the 32 conferences of the United States are divided among those 10. And so I would have, for instance, the Big West. I would not have the Big West. You never have your own conference. I might have, and they wouldn't give me the Big, the Pac-10 either, because I had coached in the conference and played in the conference. So I had the WCC, for instance, 1 year. But I might have the Big Sky. I could have the SEC. I could have the Big 12. So you'd have those conferences. Then everyone is assigned three or four secondary conferences. You would be the secondary to someone else. We would have conference calls monthly, if not more frequently, with conference commissioners and the sports information directors in those conference offices who really gave us insight. I watched more games. I will guarantee you, I watched more basketball games than anyone in this country. It was nothing for me to watch parts of 20 games on a Saturday, and I loved it. And I could click over to another game if something was going awry. We also were given the codes so we could go in on our computers and access games that were played during the week that maybe were not on television, and we could watch a half or the whole game if we chose to that would come out of the conference
office. Now, what are you looking for when you're watching the games?
Well, everybody looks through a different lens again. And for me, first and foremost is guard play. Next is rebounding. For me personally, I think those two factors are absolutely crucial in having success. Then I look to assist to turnover ratio. Obviously, I'm looking at style of play, because when you get in the tournament, everyone slows it down. It becomes much more of a half-court game. This past year, we saw Rick Pitino and the Louisville team speed things up, distort the game, and wear teams out. And that was a bold move on his part, but that's the way they practice, and that's the whole idea. Defensively, can I cause that team to play differently than they normally play? So half-court teams that are already used to grinding it out and coming off a double screen and getting a shot under pressure, they're a little more adept at conforming to what needs to be done during March Madness. So I'm looking at a lot of things. And one of the funny things that occurred in the conference room when we were sequestered is that the others would ask me, all right, Stan, we have Syracuse, and they're playing Michigan State, neutral court. Well, what I used to say is, neutral court, shirts against skins, who wins? And then I would start evaluating guard play, rebounding, inside out, specialties, meaning out of bounds plays, free throw lane assignments, presses, and things of that nature, and get down and then make a decision. Here's who I pick, and here's why. Also, coaches. Boy, that has a lot of impact, as you all know. Who's good? Who's been there? Who hasn't? Who has demonstrated that they know how to come back? And depth, team depth plays a role in it. So there's so much, you can't believe it. And when you're in that room, the amount of information you are given is absolutely startling. Everything about every single team is right there in front of you, and there's a staff of over a dozen people from the NCAA that provide that information instantaneously upon request.
Now, we had a conversation a few years ago, and you were telling me about the amount of money that comes in from this tournament and how it affects collegiate athletics throughout the nation. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yes. March Madness pays for the championship of every single sport in the NCAA except football in Division I, Division II, and Division III. I'm talking about every flight, every bus trip, every single meal, every hotel room, every official, every venue for the rental on the venue, every award, all of that is paid for by the March Madness. It truly is the golden goose.
It is for the NCAA, isn't it?
It absolutely is. That's why when we put that contract together, and I was fortunate to be a part of the committee at that time, we put a contract together between Turner Broadcasting and CBS that pays the NCAA over a 14-year period of time $10.8 billion, that's a B as in boy, billion dollars. That's why everyone works to get in, and that's why you're playing in arenas. Next year you'll have 90,000 5,000 people in Jerry Jones's stadium in Texas, and 65,000 outside watching on a large screen. It'd be the largest basketball audience in the history of anywhere.
And your tenure with that was how long?
5 years.
5 years.
That's how long you're on.
Now, you've been known for your dedication to the student athlete. In fact, you've been called a tireless advocate for enhancing student athletic academic support programs. Tell us about the support programs at UCR that are available to student athletes coming on the campus.
Well, the truth is that they come pretty well equipped. You better be a good student if you're going to go to a UC institution, and UCR is no exception. And that means you understand what time management is, you understand what homework is, you understand responsibilities in terms of attending class and getting assignments in, and understand the rigors of putting in 20 hours a week of hard work in your sport and still competing daily in the classroom. You know, pick your discipline. And so they have the student assistance program in athletics, the academic program that monitors a lot of the work. Most of the teams do have study tables, especially for new kids who are getting a feel for this new academic climate. We don't have enough people at UCR in athletics to oversee that. There are centers on campus that assist in the process. One of the things I'm very, very proud of is when we put in our study room downstairs and an adjacent computer room. And there are about 20 computers in there where kids can do work through the course of the day. That was, I thought, a great enhancement to athletics. Other institutions will have as many as a dozen people or even more. There are places that have 40 people to assist student athletes in specific work, tutoring in specific subjects, or simply some basic skills that you need to understand. Time management is a difficult one for an athlete. Every hour free is really important. A lot of kids won't start studying unless they know they have a block of 3 hours. I'm telling you, that hour between your English class that you have free until your Spanish class, that hour is crucial, and you can accomplish a lot in terms of reviewing what you just did and then what you need to know for your next class. And so I think that the assistance that we have at UCR on hand is really wonderful in assisting kids in those areas.
So what do you say when you're out recruiting? What would you say to a potential recruit about Riverside, about the campus? What was your sales pitch to these kids?
Well, so often kids, particularly out of state or out of country, you know, if I was talking to a kid, I would say the following. We're in California. Understand something. That is magic to
That's
49 other states.
Right.
But you also understand, if you're saying that to an out-of-state kid, the cost of a scholarship is double an in-state scholarship plus an additional $1,000. Mm. So that's a very lucrative gesture that you're going to make right there for that kid. But the fact remains that California is magic. And so then they say, well, where's Riverside located? I tell them they are 1 hour from where the Lakers play. They're 45 minutes from Palm Springs. They're an hour from the snow in the mountains and an hour from the surf at Newport Beach. And the kid says, send me a ticket.
Sign me up.
Oh, you bet. And it's all true. That's true. But Riverside is a very special city. And, you know, I call this home. I love the city of Riverside so much. I'm very, very fond of it because they care about each other here. And they care about quality of life issues so much here. And they work at it. They work at it diligently. And so when I'm talking to kids and they get a chance to meet people in the community, you know, you got to be very, very selective because the NCAA has rules about who they can and cannot meet. The fact remains, I also tell them that it, you know, as one of the most diverse campuses in America, when you walk on campus, it's like a United Nations. And one of the great things for a minority student is, you know, they may think they're different. The common denominator on campus is everyone is different. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, they're all alike. I never forget having an exit interview with a young man from basketball who was the MVP of the team. And I said, when you came here, you heard about the diversity. What have you found? And he said, Coach, look at me. He said, I'm the blackest dude you've ever seen. I said, yes, you are. He said, Coach, I walked outside and I looked around and everybody was so different. He said, I'm thankful for this. I was raised in an all-black environment. I came here and nobody was checking me out. We all got along. We all interfaced with each other. We spent time with each other in class and at activities on campus. He said, this is the best experience of my life because it prepared me for a real world.
Stan, we have to wrap up, but I want to thank you for coming out to the show today. As I said earlier, You've really been a mentor to a number of individuals here in the city. You're a community leader. We're fortunate to have you here in the city of Riverside. That's all the time we have for this edition of Explore Riverside Weekly. I want to thank Stan Morrison again for joining us on the show. Make sure you tune in to Explore Riverside Weekly every Saturday afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Brought to you by the City of Riverside. You can also visit us on the web at exploreriverside.com.